Welcome to the Gren Zone. Dissecting dermatology differently. Here is your host, Dr. Logan.
Hello, everyone. I am definitely not Dr. Logan Kolb. My name is Dr. Nate Marroquin, and I am an intern dermatology resident hosting the show for you today, and we'll be talking about hypopigmented lesions. Why are hypopigmented lesions important enough to obtain its own episode? Yes, hypopigmented skin changes are often asymptomatic and benign, but these lesions can be the first clinical signs of a serious underlying disease, such as ash leaf macules seen in kids with tuberous sclerosis or the salt and pepper pigmentation in systemic sclerosis. There is a large differential that we must all be aware of, for which we have a great mnemonic using the word paints that we'll be going over today. And luckily enough, we'll have Dr. Grumpy Pants joining us.
What happened to the former resident? Did he have to take a wellness day and go pet some puppies because his workload was too much for his small brain and even smaller drive for success?
Before we discuss this differential, we will mention this disclaimer. This episode is meant for educational informational purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, nor does it represent the views of Orange Park Medical Center, Olmsted Medical Center, or their affiliates. Before we discuss our hypopigmented lesion diffy, let's quickly go over the difference between hypopigmented and depigmented lesions. Hypopigmentation is an umbrella term that refers to any form of decreased or absent skin pigmentation caused by the changes in melanin, hemoglobin, or any other causes. Nevus anemicus and pityriasis alba are two examples we will discuss. Hypomelanosis specifically refers to the reduction of epidermal melanin. Depigmentation refers to the complete loss of pigment, as seen with vitiligo. Depigmented lesions appear stark white with Wood's lamp exam, while hypopigmented lesions accentuate to a lesser extent with Wood's lamp.
Okay, you are slightly more tolerable than the usual parasite disguised as a resident. So what is on your differential for hypopigmented lesions?
Well, thanks, Dr. G. But for the differential of hypopigmented lesions, we need to remember the mnemonic paints, with P for post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, pityriasis alba, piebaldism, progressive macular hypomelanosis, pinta, and pigmentary mosaicism. A is for ash leaf macules, I for idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis, aka IGH, N for nevus depigmentosus and nevus anemicus, T for tinea versicolor, and S for scleroderma with the classic salt and pepper appearance, sarcoidosis, and steroids. Again, for hypopigmented lesions, remember paints, with P for post-inflammatory hypopigmentation, pityriasis alba, piebaldism, progressive macular hypomelanosis, pinta, and pigmentary mosaicism. A for ash leaf macules, I for idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis, N is for nevus depigmentosus and nevus anemicus, T is for tinea versicolor, and S is for scleroderma, sarcoidosis, and steroids. For the purpose of this episode, we will discuss the more important or commonly encountered diagnoses in detail. The others we will simply mention so you'll still have that expanded differential diagnosis.
Simply mention? You imbeciles love to gloss over that of which you know nothing. I see it all the time in your lectures. We are just going to gloss over B-cell lymphomas or blastic plasmacytoid dendritic cell neoplasm. Why don't you just learn it in real time?
So, to start off with the P and paints, we will start with probably the most common acquired cause of hypopigmentation, post-inflammatory hypopigmentation. Post-inflammatory hypopigmentation can develop from 1. Inflammation from other rashes such as atopic dermatitis or seborrheic dermatitis, which was discussed in episode 6, way back when, 2. Trauma to the skin, or 3. From a variety of skin treatments such as hydroquinone. It is key to identify the underlying etiology and controlling the inflammation as the first stage of management. Many of these conditions can also cause post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, therefore it's best to say the full name rather than calling it PIH.
Hudson has had these white spots on his cheeks for weeks, and we need them gone now. We have been to 45 other dermatologists, 12 different allergists, and 16 homeopathic doctors. We have a medicine cabinet full of creams. I can't even afford a new Stanley tumbler. And guess what? He still has a rash.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about Hudson, but pityriasis alba is seen in prepubertal children, usually between the ages 3 and 16, and presents as hypopigmented macules or patches that may have subtle scale and a defined but irregular border, typically seen on the malar area and the forehead. Pityriasis alba is typically seen in kids who have a history of asthma, hay fever, eczema, and/or xerosis, and typically worsens during the summer months due to sun exposure tanning the adjacent unaffected skin. The diagnosis for pityriasis alba is usually clinical. It is a self-limiting process, but there are helpful treatments including moisturizing skincare routines, low-potency corticosteroids, or calcineurin inhibitors like pimecrolimus or tacrolimus, along with sun-protective measures to avoid tanning adjacent skin, which makes lesions more prominent. The next condition in Paine's hypopigmented differential is P for piebaldism. Piebaldism is an autosomal dominant disorder caused by mutation in the KIT proto-oncogene that leads to the abnormal melanocyte migration from the neural crest cells. Again, piebaldism is an autosomal dominant disorder caused by a mutation in the KIT proto-oncogene that leads to the abnormal melanocyte migration from the neural crest cells.
The hairstyles of today make it look like everyone has a C-KIT mutation. Now, tell me, what other dermatologic conditions result from C-KIT mutations?
C-KIT mutations are also seen in mastocytosis along with acral or mucosal melanomas. But when C-KIT mutations occur in piebaldism patients, the mutation drives leucoderma, affecting the central forehead, central frontal scalp, mid portion of the extremities, and central anterior trunk. Another common finding in piebaldism is poliosis, which means patients develop a white lock of hair on the mid-frontal scalp. Piebaldism itself is benign, with depigmentation being permanent and typically non-progressive. When the diagnosis of piebaldism is suspected, a thorough examination should be conducted to exclude Waardenburg syndrome, which is a rare disorder characterized by facial dysmorphism, diminished pigmentation of the skin, hair, or iris, and sensory-neural hearing loss. Treatment for piebaldism is aimed to improve cosmesis with skin grafting, cell transplantation, and the use of hair dye for the accompanying poliosis. Next, we will discuss progressive macular hypomelanosis. PMH typically presents in young females with symmetric, hypopigmented, poorly demarcated, smooth macules or patches on the lower back or abdomen. There isn't a clear etiology, but it seems that C. acnes can be a contributor to the development of PMH. A sure way to diagnose progressive macular hypomelanosis is with a Wood's lamp, which will show the pathognomonic finding of punctiform red to orange fluorescence localized to the follicles. A quick Google search of this finding will lock this into your memory. Some effective therapy for PMH includes phototherapy, combined topical benzoyl peroxide plus clindamycin, as well as oral isotretinoin. Repigmentation has been seen in greater than 80% of patients with UVB. Progressive macular hypomelanosis is typically self-limiting and benign. However, 72% of patients develop reoccurrence. So, we've covered post-inflammatory hypopigmentation, pityriasis alba, and progressive macular hypomelanosis. I will briefly mention pinta and pigmentary mosaicism before we move on.
The Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, Treponema caroteum while you're drinking sangria.
Pinta is caused by the bacteria Treponema caroteum, which is only found in rural Central and South America, and commonly affects children and young adults. Pinta infection is divided into three stages. The primary infection begins as one or several small papules, usually on the exposed surfaces of the extremities. Papules are typically painless, but may be pruritic. These primary lesions enlarge over the course of 3 to 9 months to form secondary lesions, including scaly, reddish papules, and sometimes psoriasiform plaques. Over time, the lesions eventually become hypopigmented, marking the onset of the third stage. Patients with pigmentary mosaicism present with whorled or swirling patterns of hypopigmented patches that follow the lines of Blaschko. Pigmentary mosaicism is caused by two or more genetically different populations of cells existing side by side within the skin, which mutate early in the life of the embryo. Continuing with the Paine's mnemonic for hypopigmented lesions, we now move on to A for ash leaf macules, which are the most common manifestations of tuberous sclerosis.
So what mutations cause tuberous sclerosis, and what other cutaneous changes should you be aware of?
Tuberous sclerosis is an autosomal dominant disorder affecting 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 10,000 live births and is caused by mutations in hamartin or tuberin proteins resulting in a wide variety of hamartomas. Hamartomas refer to benign growths made up of an abnormal mixture of cells and tissues. The five cutaneous findings we have to know for tuberous sclerosis patients are 1, the hypopigmented ash leaf macules, which are often present at birth and represent the first cutaneous changes in TS patients. 2, adenoma sebaceum, which are angiofibromas on the face. 3, Sjögren patches, which are connective tissue nevi that appear as fresh colored plaques of variable size. 4, Conen, spelled K-O-E-N-E-N, Conen tumors, which are fibromas around the Nell unit, and 5, café au lait macules. Again, the 5 cutaneous changes to know for tuberous sclerosis patients include ash leaf macules, adenoma sebaceum, Sjögren patches, Conen tumors, and café au lait macules. Other associated disorders with tuberous sclerosis include epilepsy, developmental delays, renal cell carcinomas, and cardiac rhabdomyomas. Ash leaf macules typically develop anywhere in infancy to childhood with well-demarcated hypopigmented lesions that can range in size from a few millimeters to several centimeters. Distribution of ash leaf macules is typically asymmetric, especially over the trunk and buttocks. Presentation is rarely on the face, and if it affects the scalp, patches of polyposis will be present. If you were to look at a biopsy of an ash leaf macule, you would see a normal number of melanocytes but less melanin. The use of Wood's lamp can be helpful in revealing spots that are harder to visualize on fair-skinned patients. So far, we have covered P for post-inflammatory hypopigmentation, pityriasis alba, piebaldism, progressive macular hypomelanosis, pinta, and pigmentary mosaicism. A is for ash leaf macules, and now I for idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis. IGH is a chronic hypopigmented condition that is commonly seen in adults with excessive sun exposure. Think of them as white freckles.
I had one imbecile tell me he had white freckles. Another was convinced it was from motor oil exposure. And still, Cindy from HR swears she was never in the sun. Do you know what all these people have in common? None of them have any hope of ever being able to pronounce the words idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis.
Idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis is most often characterized by sharply demarcated hypopigmented to depigmented macules seen over the sun-exposed extremities. They are often left untreated, but some options include cryotherapy, topical and intralesional steroids, topical retinoids like tretinoin, and a variety of lasers. Next up, we are going to discuss the N of paints, which stands for nevus depigmentosus and nevus anemicus. Nevus depigmentosus is a misnomer because it's actually not depigmented, but rather a hypopigmented patch. It typically presents at birth or within the first few months of life as a common, congenital, non-progressive, hypopigmented lesion that is stable in shape and distribution, but its size grows in proportion to overall body growth. Nevus depigmentosus results from a functional deficiency in melanosome transfer from melanocytes to keratinocytes. It typically presents as a solitary, unilateral, hypopigmented patch with irregular, serrated borders, which commonly do not cross the midline. There are no known associated disorders with nevus depigmentosus, and since it's hypopigmented, it does not accentuate to the extent that a depigmented lesion like vitiligo would.
Ah, tell me about nevus anemicus. I think your colleague, Dr. Kolb, has cerebral anemicus.
Nevus anemicus is also a congenital, non-progressive skin anomaly that is commonly seen as a solitary, well-defined, hypopigmented, abnormally shaped patch on the trunk that is first noticed in early childhood or sometimes at birth. It is actually unrelated to true pigment changes, but is instead a localized vascular variance where the vessels are hypersensitive to catecholamines, which leads to vasoconstriction and consequently pallor of the affected skin that mimics hypopigmentation. Again, nevus anemicus is a hypopigmented patch resulting from localized blood vessels that are hypersensitive to catecholamines, which leads to vasoconstriction and consequently pallor of the affected skin. Nevus anemicus skin lesions characteristically does not create reactive erythema in response to heat, cold, or trauma. This can be tested on physical exam by vigorously rubbing the lesion and surrounding skin or applying ice or heat, which will accentuate the lesion by causing reactive erythema in the surrounding skin while the nevus anemicus lesion maintains a persistent pallor. Nevus anemicus can be seen in association with neurofibromatosis, phacomatosis pigmentovascularis, Legius syndrome, and Noonan syndrome. Nevus anemicus is often misdiagnosed as vitiligo. However, keep in mind that Wood's lamp will not highlight nevus anemicus because pigment is normal. Vitiligo will appear stark white. Treatment is not necessary unless there are signs of phacomatosis pigmentovascularis. Then we refer the patient to vascular workup. Our tea and paint stands for tinea versicolor, aka pityriasis versicolor, which was covered in episode 9, so we'll keep it brief.
What causes the hyperpigmentation in tinea versicolor? You better know this one, or you can march right back to that little podunk town you are from and tell your mommy you're no better than a cotton-headed ninny-muggin.
Wow. Well, here goes nothing. Tinea versicolor is a superficial fungal infection whereby Malassezia yeast digests oils on the skin into azelaic acid, which inhibits melanocyte melanin production, leading to hypopigmentation. Again, tinea versicolor is a superficial fungal infection whereby Malassezia yeast digests oils on the skin into azelaic acid, which inhibits melanocyte melanin production, leading to hypopigmentation. Of note, azelaic acid has been used as a cream topically for rosacea, but has excellent bleaching effects for melasma and hyperpigmentation. So, full circle. Tinea versicolor often appears as hypopigmentation when sun exposure tans the surrounding skin. Without the sun exposure, tinea versicolor will be tanned to red macules, patches, and plaques with scales. In skin of color, tinea versicolor can appear as hyper or hypopigmentation. KOH Prep shows classic spaghetti and meatballs depicting the hyphae and spores, while treatment includes selenium sulfide or zinc pyrithione washes, topical antifungals like terbinafine, cyclopirox, ketoconazole, and oral antifungals like fluconazole for the diffuse or resistant cases. It is also important to remind your patients that hypopigmented lesions can take months to repigment following treatment. Now we'll move to S, which stands for scleroderma, sarcoidosis, and steroids.
I will hold my tongue out of respect for this condition, as it has humbled even me, the quadruple board-certified physician standing before you.
Systemic sclerosis, aka scleroderma, is an umbrella term which includes 1. Limited systemic sclerosis, which includes Kress syndrome, and 2. Diffuse systemic sclerosis. Again, systemic sclerosis, aka scleroderma, is an umbrella term which includes 1. Limited systemic sclerosis, which includes Kress syndrome, and 2. Diffuse systemic sclerosis. It is a multi-system immune condition that is often associated with prominent pigmentary changes. It can be seen in all ages. However, typical onset is between 30 and 50 years of age. It is slightly more common in African Americans and is 4 times more common in women. There are 2 pigmentary variations that can be seen in scleroderma. 1. Vitiligo-like depigmentation, also known as scleroderma leucoderma, which can spare follicles leading to the classic salt and pepper appearance of skin. And 2, diffuse hyperpigmentation accentuated in sun-exposed areas. The depigmentation with perifollicular retention is most commonly seen on the backs of the legs, but can be found on retroauricular region, scalp, forehead, chest, or trunk. Other cutaneous changes to know for scleroderma include skin tightening on the fingers called sclerodactyly, matted telangiectasias of the face and palms, calcinosis cutis, and xerotic itchy skin. The diagnosis of systemic sclerosis is supported by anti-centromere antibodies for limited systemic sclerosis. Remember the C in anti-centromere antibodies seen in Kress syndrome, whereas anti-topoisomerase 1 antibodies for diffuse systemic sclerosis. Systemic sclerosis also has extracutaneous manifestations you need to know, including interstitial lung disease, pulmonary hypertension, lower esophageal dysmotility seen in 90% of cases, gastroparesis, and scleroderma renal crisis seen in 20% of diffuse patients. Scleroderma renal crisis presents with a rapid rise in creatinine and marked hypertension. Treatment of systemic sclerosis should be managed alongside of a rheumatologist, but some treatment options include glucocorticoids, methotrexate, mycophenolate mofetil, and ACE inhibitors to prevent renal crisis.
Now, for one of my favorites, known by many as the great mimicker, known by me as one of the great resident stumbling blocks, and just not known at all by Dr. Kolb.
The next S we will give a brief crash course on is sarcoidosis. Sarcoidosis occurs in genetically predisposed patients who encounter a possible antigen including Mycobacterium, HSV, EBV, mold, mildew, industrial organic dust, or meds like highly active antiretroviral therapy, which sets off the formation of non-caseating granulomas. These granulomas most commonly show up in the lungs and hilar lymph nodes, but they can impact pretty much any organ system including the eyes, heart, and CNS. Common presentations include the 3 Ps with papules, plaques, or lupus perennial, along with subcutaneous sarcoid, sarcoid within scars, or the nonspecific erythema nodosum lesions. An uncommon presentation is hypopigmented sarcoidosis, normally seen in darker skin types. Hypopigmented sarcoidosis will present as papules with surrounding hypopigmentation, macules, or well-demarcated round to oval patches or plaques. The mechanism of this hypopigmentation is still unclear. However, it is believed to be attributed to inhibition of melanogenesis due to cell injury associated with inflammation. All sarcoidosis patients need to be seen by an ophthalmologist and a pulmonologist. Labs include CBC, CMP, UA, ACE levels, and quantiferin gold to rule out tuberculosis, as well as a baseline EKG. Treatment options include topical, intralesional, or systemic steroids. Steroid-sparing agents such as tetracycline antibiotics, antimalarials, methotrexate, and the TNF-alpha inhibitors adalimumab and infliximab are also used. It is important to note that intralesional steroids may cause hypopigmentation, which leads us into the final S we'll be talking about. Steroidal injections are common and extremely effective treatment for numerous dermatologic disorders such as keloids. However, these injections do not come without a risk, including atrophy and hypopigmentation at the injection site. It is thought that the steroids most likely reduce the number or activity of melanocytes, ultimately leading to hypopigmentation. The hypopigmentation occurs weeks or even months after injection and has also been reported to present in a linear fashion due to migration of steroids locally in the lymphovascular channels. Typically, spontaneous resolution occurs within 6 to 9 months. Before we wrap this thing up with the summary, let's take a quick break and listen to Thomas and the Shakes to give our brains a rest. Hypopigmented lesions can often be early clinical signs for underlying disorders such as the ash leaf macule seen in tuberous sclerosis or the salt and pepper appearance seen in systemic scleroderma. For hypopigmented lesions, remember the mnemonic PAINTS, with P for post-inflammatory hypopigmentation, pityriasis alba, piebaldism, progressive macular hypomelanosis, pinta, and pigmentary mosaicism. A is for ash leaf macules, I for idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis, aka IGH, N for nevus depigmentosus and nevus anemicus, T for tinea versicolor, and S for scleroderma with the classic salt and pepper appearance, sarcoidosis, and steroids. Pityriasis alba, which is seen in prepubertal children with a distribution on the malar ridges and the forehead, typically resolves after puberty, and don't forget to ask about family atopy. Piebaldism is a c-kit mutation that leads to abnormal melanocyte migration from neural crest cells. The mutation leads to leukoderma affecting the central forehead, central frontal scalp, mid portion of the extremities, and central anterior trunk, and don't forget to keep an eye out for polyosis. Progressive macular hypomelanosis is most often seen in young females that presents with symmetric, hypopigmented, poorly demarcated, smooth macules or patches that is believed to be caused by C. acnes. We also don't want to forget about pinta and pigmentary mosaicism. A stands for ash leaf macules, which is the most common manifestation of tuberous sclerosis complex. It typically presents as well-demarcated margins that can range in size from a few millimeters to several centimeters, and distribution is typically asymmetrical, especially over the trunk and buttocks of patients. I stands for idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis. IGH is a chronic hypopigmented condition that presents as sharply demarcated hypopigmented to depigmented macules seen over the extremities. Remember that there are two disorders that stand for N. The first being nevus depigmentosus, which is a congenital, non-progressive, hypopigmented macular patch that is unilateral with irregular, serrated borders that often do not cross midline. Nevus anemicus is a solitary, well-defined, hypopigmented, abnormally shaped patch on the trunk due to persistent vasoconstriction rather than from true pigmentary changes. T is for tinea versicolor, which again we covered way back in episode 9. But as another review, it is caused by superficial fungal infection with Malassezia furfur that often manifests during puberty. Remember that it occurs in a more sunny and humid climate and the hypopigmentation is caused by Malassezia yeast digesting oils on the skin into azelaic acid, which inhibits melanocyte melanin production. And don't forget the classic spaghetti and meatball appearance on KOH. And last but not least, S. Remember the salt and pepper appearance of scleroderma leucoderma, and that it is characterized by depigmentation with perifollicular retention. It is key to remember that the salt and pepper appearance can be the first manifestation of systemic sclerosis. Sarcoidosis hypopigmentation is a well-recognized cutaneous manifestation predominantly affecting dark-skinned patients. These lesions may appear as well-demarcated patches or plaques that present mostly on the extremities and occurs in 25 to 30% of patients. The final S stands for steroids, which refers to steroidal injections. These lesions are rare and present as linear or branched and may be accompanied with atrophy. Alright everyone, this was a long one with a lot of information, but with all things, repetition is key, so go back and listen to this one a few times. Also, if you have enjoyed this show at any point, please leave us a review and share it with your friends. As Dr. Kolb always says, take some time to yourself and relax. You've earned it.
Alright my friends, thanks so much for joining today. I want to share many thanks to those who have made this podcast possible, starting with my former program director, Dr. Karthik Krishnamurthy, for not only supporting this podcast from the get-go, but also adding time-tested clinical pearls that you can't find in the textbooks and journals. I also want to thank Dr. Sean Schmieder for his help with both the content and also with the many voices for our quirky cast of characters. More thanks go out to my brother Garrett and Dan Thompson for their work with editing and post-production, along with our excellent team of students and residents, including Dave Smith, Dan Hyman, Sandra Oska, Jake Nelson, Wesley Carter, and Courtney Heron, who have all contributed in one way or another to support our social media platforms and create a super useful study guide that is available for each episode at grenzonederm.com. And that is with two Z's, grenzonederm.com. Another shout out to Jarrett Anderson for his work with the Anki decks that are also available on the website. And a final shout out to you, the listeners from around the globe who have faithfully listened and supported this podcast since its inception in 2019. Okay, that's the list for now. I'm Logan Kolb. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time here in the Gren Zone.
This episode is copyright 2024 Pearl Podcasting LLC, all rights reserved. The Gren Zone podcast is a service provided by Pearl Podcasting LLC and is not affiliated with any other service providers.